This is a download from the Post-Keynesian Economics Study Group, PKSG. For more information and terms of use, please visit www.postkeynesian.net.
Hello and welcome to the Keynes Seminar at Robinson College, Cambridge. My name is Mark Hayes, Fellow in Economics here at Robinson. On the 16th of October 2012, our main speaker was Professor John Maloney, who presented his paper on the relationship between the British Treasury and the New Cambridge School in the 1970s, followed by a response from Dr. Graham Gudgeon. Graham Gudgeon is currently Research Associate at the Centre for Business Research here in Cambridge and part-time Senior Economic Advisor with Oxford Economics. He spent many years as the Director of the Northern Ireland Economic Research Centre and was formerly a Senior Research Officer in the Department of Applied Economics, and a member of the Cambridge Economic Policy Group, as well as Fellow in Economics at Selwyn College, Cambridge.
Well, I'd like to start by thanking John for that paper. I mean, it's a particular interest, I guess, to those of us who were around at the time. And I was in Wynne's policy group, Wynne Godley's policy group, from 1978, so it's really came in at the end of this action, but certainly the ramifications of that were still going on. But I think it's important, I mean, it's of wider importance for a number of reasons, which I'd stress. Others of you may have other reasons. But one is that it was perhaps the last great engagement of academic economists and the Treasury and government in a public debate. And it did catch public imagination, I mean, to the extent that this actually reached the front page of Private Eye at one point, under the headline Mad Cambridge Professor Advocates 60 Million Unemployed and Giant Carnivorous Voles on the M1. But I think it had a lasting resonance because, in a way, a lot of the advice was felt to be ineffective and perhaps with import controls, I mean, politically unworldly in a sense. And combined, I think, with the advice of the 364 economists, which was also strongly associated with Cambridge, really led to a frostiness between, or a lack of interest, politicians for academic economic advice, which has lasted for decades. And I think if we look at the period since then, that there hasn't really been a similar public policy debate of this sort. I mean, there was a spat between Alan Walters and the Treasury in the later 1980s. And some people might say, well, we have a monetary committee now, and we had a committee of economic wise men. But it's very hard to see them engaging in anything but rather minor controversy here, but their sort of thing. And even then, academic economists, in the sense of university-based economists, are not very well represented on, at least on the monetary committee. At least not UK academic economists. The second reason for the importance of this is, I think the 1970s really was the pivotal period in post-war economic policy. Up until the 1970s, the UK economy was heavily controlled, much government ownership of commerce and industry, and widespread regulation, including capital controls and at various times wage and price controls that John's referred to, as well as Keynesian demand management. After the 1970s, and particularly from the early Thatcher period, there's been much more market liberalism. And one can, I think, describe the CEPG's views as an attempt to continue the former regime, or at least not to question it in any fundamental way, and to cure its persistent problems, which, as John has said, tended to revolve around balance of payments problems, through things like import controls. And even if those problems look rather minor in retrospect, they were the big problems of the day. The CPG, actually, I mean, Wynne himself actually wasn't all that left-wing. We never knew which way he voted, but we suspected he was a sort of moderate Tory. Really, his friends tended to be moderate Tories and came very much from that sort of upper-class and public school background. But Francis Cripps certainly was strongly associated with the Labour Party, became a Tony Benn advisor, and was taking the Labour Party much further left than it necessarily wanted to go, and didn't in the end go. He, I suppose, was in the mould of his grandfather, Sir Stafford Cripps, who was Chancellor of the Exchequer, and some people's verdict was one of the strongest advocates for Indian independence, but very much a left-wing liberal figure. The provenance of the new Cambridge ideas are, I think, very well described in the preface of Wynne's Godley's last, and to my mind, greatest book, Monetary Economics, written with Marc Lavoie, and published in Wynne's 81st year in 2007, close to the end of his long and very productive life. He wrote, "I remember a Damascene moment when in early 1974, after playing around with concepts devised by Nicholas Kaldor and Robert Neild, I first apprehended," a very godlyish verb, "I first apprehended the strategic importance of the accounting identity which says that, measured at current prices, the government's public budget deficit less the current account deficit is equal, by definition, to private saving net of investment." He then went on to add, "Having always thought of the balance of trade as something that could only be analysed in terms of income and price elasticities, together with real output movements at home and abroad, it came as a shock to discover that only if one knows what the budget deficit and private net saving are, it follows from that information alone," and then he adds another very godly thing, "without any qualification whatsoever, exactly what the balance of payments must be." And those views, of course, underlined what John was saying, the policy recommendation that since the private deficit, the private balance was relatively stable, the other two tended to be offsetting and could be used as policy levers. Now, in his later days, much of that new Cambridge idea, the policy recommendations, were really dropped. They don't really appear in the Godley-Lavoie book of 2007. But Wynne's ideas on advising on macroeconomic policy nearly always started from that insight that there were three balances, the three big sectors, private, government and rest of the world, which had to add up to zero, which had to balance. And one could always use that as a source of insight. He relied very heavily on the three balances approach in his work at Levy College in the US in the last decade of his life, reaching the conclusion round about period 2004 to 2006, really, that the imbalances built up in the first years of the 21st century were unsustainable and would lead to recession. He was there talking more about the US, which he came to work on, than the UK, but he would have applied the ideas to both. He was unable to be precise about the timing of the crash or of its precise nature. And one can add in parenthesis, I think, that Wynne's one-time colleague at Levy, Hyman Minsky, is much better on the nature of a crash. Even though Minsky's great book, Stabilising an Unstable Economy, was actually written in 1986, but it's very prescient in talking about the current crisis. One of Wynne's, the more recent of Wynne's views based on the three balances identity, has been to ridicule the idea that governments can feasibly set targets for government deficits, as they commonly do, and particularly in the euro area where they're devoted to such things. And as is obvious in the eurozone, government deficits are the outcome of a wide range of behaviour in the private sector at home and abroad, and not within the control of governments. I think it's actually part of the German constitution now that they were from about 2015 that they have to balance their budget. We'll see how they manage with that, or what havoc they wreak on the rest of Europe by doing so. In his later days, Wynne focused mainly on the US economy, and as a result, I feel, got relatively little publicity in the UK. It tended to be a historic rather than current figure. and was perhaps wrongly regarded in some quarters as one of those dismal economists who tended to predict 5 out of the last 3 recessions. But that's very unfair. He did have a strong view that the way economies were going in this century were completely unsustainable, and I think was very much been vindicated by what happened. The three balances approach lives on after Wynne, I think, as much as anywhere, in the journalism of Martin Wolf in the Financial Times, who makes very good use of this approach to comment insightfully on trends in the world economy, including, of course, China's great, huge trade surplus. But let me go back to the 1970s for a minute. And as John suggested, Wynne, and together with Francis Cripps, had much initial success using this approach in generating more accurate predictions than other forecasters like the National Institute or the London Business School, where forecasting was then led by Terry Burns, who later to become government chief economist. Predictions included the 1974 economic bust and inflation exceeding 20%. But Wynne states, again in the preface to his recent book, "Much more important than any predictions was our suggestion that an altogether different set of principles for managing the economy should be adopted." And this was, of course, the New Cambridge Principle, which was actually named, I don't think John said, unless I missed it, by his opponents in this debate, Richard Kahn and Michael Posner at Cambridge. And which was based on the view that over the medium term, there were limits to the extent to which private net savings would fluctuate, and hence there was a medium-term functional relationship between private disposable income and private expenditure, which gave you a fairly stable financial balance, and that stability could be exploited for policy terms, as John has well explained. Wynne believed to the end that these ideas gradually gained some acceptance, but if so, it seems to me to have been within a pretty small circle of people, but again, others may have comments on that. And it might be better to describe some of the New Cambridge ideas of the time as an example of Goodhart's law, which says that economic regularities break down as soon as they're discovered, however long the evidence for them is. But what we can say, I think, and this comes on to this slide that you can see on the screen, which by the way shows the private sector surplus or deficit as a percentage of GDP, which is the vertical scale. First thing to say is that the average version of this ratio doesn't actually change very much. It's about 1%. Sorry, it's as a percentage of private income, not GDP, but not far different. The average level, which is shown by the red dotted line, doesn't actually change very much over the period. And to that extent, there still is a basis for New Cambridge principles, as Bill Martin has showed very well in his very rigorous CBR paper. But what has changed is the volatility. So we can see in the period before the mid-1970s, there was year-to-year variation in the size of the surplus, but that variation was pretty small, and it's that really underlined the medium-term stability. There is also still a quite reasonable functional relationship between private sector expenditure and private disposable income, again as Bill Martin has shown, although Bill feels this has broken down in the extreme conditions of 2008 and 2009. And we can see from the slide that the private sector surplus goes outside any historical experience, going right back to the war. And there was some feeling that the volatility in the private sector surplus was caused by growing inflation. But we can see from this slide that even when inflation got low after 1990, the volatility of anything increased. This has become a very, very volatile relationship. and one would say, I think, of limited or no use for the policy prescriptions that Wynne and Francis were outlining in the 1970s. And also, with the increase in volatility in the private sector ratio, the tendency of the other two balancing deficits, the government deficit and the balance of payments deficit, the tendency for those to offset one another, which again was an important point of the policy prescriptions, we can see that that pretty well broke down after the 1970s. If anything, the two tended to go in the same direction. We see in the current crisis, right up to 2011 there, there's no great relationship at all. The reasons for the change in the stability of the private sector balance are not well understood, but in my view are most likely to be a product of financial liberalisation. Since the early 1970s, a deregulated banking sector has been able to expand lending simultaneously to both the household sector and to companies, leading to periods of feast and famine in place of the more placid conditions before the 1970s, in the 1950s and 60s, when the household spending tended to offset investment and vice versa, probably because of a shortage of finance. So most of the savings of the household sector would have gone in then to finance in company investment. But after 1980, there was much more freedom and flexibility, which has led to a much more, as Hyman Minsky would have predicted, a much more unstable economy. So, finally, what's left of New Cambridge? As satirical messages on student T-shirts used to proclaim in the early 1980s in reference to the policy group's left-wing image. The three balances, I think, first point, three balances remains a useful starting point in analysing national and global macroeconomic trends, but must be interpreted with considerable subtlety. Secondly, it is possible to estimate private expenditure functions in place of the more conventional consumer spending and investment functions, and to make some use of a degree of stability in the ratio of disposable income to the private sector net asset stock. However, much more work is needed than the policy group ever attempted on the reasons for such stable ratios. Wynne himself always relied implicitly on the view that it was unreasonable to expect the stock of assets to rise or fall indefinitely relative to income. But he did too little, I think, to explain how long-term stability was maintained in practice. Although one, I think, could say that he's done much to rectify that omission in the Godley Levoir book, which I find a great book and one of the great expositions of Keynesian economics in a stock flow consistent setting. So finally, perhaps you'd allow me just one last reflection on the period that John's described. The world that Wynne was dealing with was one of relative stability, right up until the mid-1970s, maintained by many controls, particularly over lending and on capital movements. The policy group failed to persuade policymakers that even more controls, in their case import controls, were necessary. Instead, the Thatcher government built on earlier moves towards a much more deregulated economy. And the current crisis, the one we're in now, has led to much questioning about whether the existing degree of deregulation is destabilising, as Minsky predicts that it always will be, and as Wynne would have agreed. So I just want to finish just by looking at the path of GDP since the war, covering the two periods, the period that Wynne would have grown up in and learnt his economics, and the subsequent post-Thatcher period. So there's the path of real GDP per head, and I superimposed that a trend of growth at 2.25% per annum And what we can see there is from 1950, really up until the end of the 1970s, the economy hardly deviated from that path at all. It really looks very stable. And the instability that bothered policymakers during that period was real, in a sense. The balance of payments constraints were real, because without flexible exchange rates, the country was always due to run out of foreign exchange reserves, and things had to be reined back. But they were done in such a way that there was stability, and for most of this period, close to full employment as well. Since 1980 and Mrs. Thatcher, what we can see is a much more volatile economy, not on a year-to-year basis, but on a big cyclical swing basis. But what's very obvious is that the economy struggles to get back to that trend, never really manages for more than a year or two. And in the current position, which I'm increasingly thinking of as the great dislocation, this is a great change from anything that's happened in the 60 years after the war. It really looks as if we're never going to get back to that trend. I mean, it's almost impossible to imagine it now. The growth rates would have to be so big for so long. And it's hard to see what would actually generate growth rates of consistently 4 or 5% per annum for decades length. So my conclusion in this, don't know if many other people would agree, is that deregulation really hasn't benefited us very much. It's given us a more unequal and more volatile economy, and one in the end that has crashed. And the bad old world of more inflation, of controls, of government ownership, of intensely irritating trade union leaders, and all the rest of it, actually produced a better result. But that really takes us rather beyond what we're talking about here, but I think is an important part of the context. And with that, I'll finish. Thank you.